Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be discussing in this episode are the top 300 trade and graphic novel sales sold through Diamond to direct market retailers for May 2016. Again, this is sell-in information. That means what the publishers consider sold and the retailers have bought, but not what they have actually sold to us, the readers. We just don't have that kind of information. And obviously, you go into a comic book store that's got a good trade selection, and there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of trades sitting on there, on their shelves and stuff. But, I mean, that's part of what makes this fun, is they'll buy some of that stuff the first month it comes out, and it may take them a couple of months to a year or longer, depending on it, to turn that into a sale. And then, you know, depending how long that took, they may or may not continue to reorder it and keep it on their shelves. They may say, hey, I was lucky to get rid of it and move on. It's funny because given how much of the comic book market, I think, is almost literally day of release sales. And if it's not literally that, it's the week of, or at least until that next issue comes out. With trades, the shelf life can just be insanely long. As we're going to find out from top item on the list this time around. But before we get to that, the breakdown of the top 300 trades, we had 29.24% go to DC by units, 27.48% by units to Marvel, and 26.25% to Image. So really, I mean, not that much of a difference between our lead publishers in the top 300. You add up everybody else, it's a little over 17%, 17.03%. So it's kind of the almost four-way split. You know, DC, Marvel, Image, and then everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You do it by dollars, and it gets a little bit more interesting, with Marvel taking 33.64% of the total dollars for the top 300 items, 32.7% going to DC, and only 19.09% going to Image, which, of course, is a reflection of a much, much lower average price for the item on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody else accounts for about 14.57% of the total dollars for the top 300. Obviously, when we're doing the total dollars here, we're doing it at full cover price. Obviously, the publishers aren't making that, because otherwise the retailers wouldn't be making anything. They'd be doing this as a charity, and that's a really bad business plan. So, you know, it's but this is a decent measure of how the dollars go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have exactly how much is spent at an invoiced amount. Simply because that's dependent on how much each individual retailer has ordered from the various publishers to get to their discount bracket. It's crazy convoluted on that stuff. So, once we get past DC, Marvel, and Image, you know, Dark Horse and IDW have a couple of percent, 4.55 for Dark Horse, 3.89 for IDW. From there, it really drops off. A Boom with 2.45%, Viz with 1.18%, Valiant with 1.07%, and then we're down at like below 0.6 of a percent.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't bad. I mean, when you've only got an item or two on the list, that's going to happen. So,
it is interesting to see that Tokyo Pop is publishing again. I know that there was a period of time when they were having financial difficulties and they weren't publishing, at least in the North American market. And now that I think they're doing some more licensing things, and it is interesting to see them back in the market.
It is. Because at one point, they were just really dominant in terms of the manga stuff. You know, Chris and I would always be having a little bit of a challenge trying to figure out what some of these titles were, you know, Fruits Basket and things like that, because neither of us read manga.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when Borders kind of ceased to be, that was a little bit of a blow, I think, to the American manga market. And it seems to, I don't want to say be stabilizing or whatever, but I hope it makes a comeback, because I think that material brings in just a fundamentally different audience and one that, you know, I think American comics may not be serving as well. And if that can help get them into comic book stores, branch them out into some other material and stuff, and vice versa, get those of us reading, you know, American comics, you know, exposed to some of this other stuff.
Yeah, and I think one of the big benefits that manga has is the huge wide variety of material. They know they have material in any genre, oftentimes many genres that Western comics have kind of given up on. And given up on, I know, maybe a strong word, but in some ways apparently isn't successfully sales-wise. Well, so there's a lot of romance manga. There's a lot of really obscure manga, obscure genres. Like, we're talking sports manga. Like, there's manga on golf. There's manga on cooking. There's manga on really esoteric stuff that you really would have a hard time finding a big enough market to support in the Western comics making industry. So it's good that when manga is successful and is strong, because it offers a huge variety.
Well, yeah, because I don't think some of these are genres that just didn't succeed in the U.S. I think some of these are genres that were never attempted in the U.S.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The cooking competition genre in particular, mm-hmm. you know, I cannot think of a single American comic that has ever even attempted that. Now, it may just be my ignorance there, but...
Well, it is kind of funny you bring that up, because there's a small one, but it in and of itself was a short series. The Brian Wood or Starve series was something somewhat cooking-related in one way, but it in and of itself only lasted 10 issues, I believe, so...
Okay, was that really... Okay, I'm not familiar with that one enough to...
So the basic premise was... one of the basic premises was it was a... there was a cook... Within the storyline, there was a cooking competition. But the hook was is that the materials that the people had to cook with were oftentimes really disturbing things. So, uh-huh. like, you know, very disturbing things, so...
We'll leave it at that.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that. That's what I'm just going to say. So
I'm easily disturbed.
You know how on the Iron Chef that they would always have, they wouldn't know what they were, you know, they would have the competitors, but then they wouldn't know what they had to choose. You know, they'd have a different food item or uh-huh. meat product. And there was a similar idea along that. And that was a big part of that comic. But issue 10 was the last issue for that. So.
Well, and how much of that series do you think was, I don't want to say in response to, but influenced by all the stuff going on in the manga?
Oh, you know, I'm not sure, because the art style is very different. But, you know, I actually haven't read the series, but I've seen the previews, the preview introduction. And then obviously I was waiting until the trades come out. I haven't read it yet, though. I just had read a synopsis.
Because I do think there are a lot of cases where American comics have been influenced heavily by foreign material. In some cases, you know, the whole British invasion stuff, where we not only were influenced by the material, but hired quite a few of the creators to good success.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there have been other cases where some of the stuff from other cultures has been, I don't want to say borrowed, but reimagined, not the reinterpreted, I think would be the way to go. I'm thinking in particular of Super Young Team and some of that stuff that Grant Morrison did, trying to bring in almost a Japanese take on superheroes into some of the DC stuff. So I think in some cases, some of these creators are aware of, but perhaps not even literally reading, some of this other material. And it still has a bizarre synergy and influence on some of the other stuff we read.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the influences, especially for the creators that have kind of been steeped in the comics from far and wide, you know?
Well, and I mean, you go to enough comic conventions and just through osmosis, you become aware of a lot of the Japanese culture, just the way that the cosplayers are and things of that sort. So even if you don't read the stuff, you start to become familiar with almost the iconography of it.
Absolutely.
Which, you know, is just good cross-fertilization of the material and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, if we jump over to the top trade list itself, top item on the list is kind of interesting. It's in with the 6,366 units, so not, you know, blowing the doors off the sales, but still, you know, it was enough to get the top of the list. And it was Batman the Killing Joke Special Edition Hardcover Reorder Activity. And, I mean, this thing's been out 3 decades or so. So for it to have topped the list again, I mean, to me, this is the epitome of kind of the justification for my no spoilers kind of attitude. Because I think some people, oh, everybody's read, you know, The Killing Joke. It's clearly not the case.
I wonder, the retail rank doesn't look drastically different, so it wasn't superly discounted. And it doesn't necessarily tie in directly to the new Suicide movie coming out. So I can't quite decide what the draw for this was. If they didn't offer it super cheaply, it's not a new edition in terms of new material. I'm kind of wondering what the draw was.
Well, the article over on ICV2 by Milton Greep, who, of course, has been following the numbers for forever. Matter of fact, he was the one who pioneered the index system we've got here. The article there was saying that Jared Leto's look of the Joker in the Suicide Squad seemed to have a definite lean towards the Killing Joke. And there's, you know, crediting that as part of it.
Okay. And that, I can kind of see that thought process, because in terms of a sellable product, it is a pretty solid story with great creators behind it, and it is a one of those perennial all-time sellers. So maybe the comic book market has said, hey, we can get behind this and maybe push this if people come into the shop from the movie or things like that.
Well, I think it's even simpler than that. You get somebody, you know, hey, you're the comic book guy at work. I saw this thing about Suicide Squad, the Joker, like an Hawaiian shirt, or, you know, whatever. The conversation starts.
Uh-huh.
Hey, you know, is there anything you think I should read? Oh, man, you've got to read The Killing Joke.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's very few definitive. I mean, there's tons of Joker stories, but very few that are that definitive.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's one of the things. Whenever anyone tries to pinpoint a direct correlation between movies and comic or trade sales, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again. There's kind of the two groups. There's the, hey, Iron Man is cool, I'll go find some Iron Man story, of which there's a bazillion. Or it's something like Watchmen, 300, where it's like, I liked this movie, here is the definitive trade that is, you know, the source material there. Same with Sin City. Again, with the Joker, the Killing Joke would be one of the first things most people would say, oh, you want to read a great Joker story? That's what to read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to a lesser degree, you see Captain America Civil War, somebody's like, well, why'd they call it Civil War? What's going on with that? They ask their buddy's buddy or whatever who's into comics, oh, well, let me tell you about the Civil War event and stuff. I mean, I've got a coworker who's gotten onto the Marvel Digital Unlimited for the main reason of reading Civil War, the original stuff.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
At rank 3, we've got it back on reorder activity. It's been on the list 101 times before.
Yeah, I actually did highlight that as well as something to talk about as seeing that come back up and, you know, wondering if we would touch on the fact that there's so oftentimes questions about what's the correlation between the media properties and the comic sales, and, you know, is it the comic stores hoping that there will be a resurgence, or is it their actual demand, you know?
Well, I would say in this case, the Captain America movie certainly didn't hurt,
mm-hmm.
but I think the bigger factor is Civil War II going on now in the Marvel Comics stuff.
That is true.
So, you know, and Civil War's, again, been on the list 101 times before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not unusual to see it at well, in rank 3 is a little unusual, but to see it on the list at all is fairly commonplace. 5,866 units, yeah, that's certainly not bad. It got in rank 3, but like 188,000 plus known sales just through Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of thing that is going to be selling in the mass market as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you only stock, say, a dozen Marvel trades, this would be one of the ones you really ought to stock.
Yeah, like along with like the Infinity Gauntlet, things like that. Yeah,
I would put it above the Infinity Gauntlet stuff. Secret Wars would be one of the other ones I would put up there. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think if literally you could only have a dozen Marvel trades,
would you stock basically one of the most popular storylines from each of your lines? Like, so one of the best X-Men storylines, one of your best Spider-Man storylines. Do you know what I mean?
I would try to be representative of as much as I could,
mm-hmm.
but I would also bias it towards what are the proven sellers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Phoenix Saga, that seems like a go-to kind of a thing. Civil War, definitely. I'm trying to think of if some of the other events were really kind of withstood the test of time. I mean, I wouldn't go out of my way to say, you know, I'm going to have the best-selling Defenders trade. Because who cares?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
But it's one of those where for some publishers, for some properties and stuff, you know, if you could only have one Iron Man trade on the shelf, what would it be? Okay, that starts to get to be a tough question.
Yeah, it does, actually.
You know, for other properties, New Teen Titans. Well, it's the Judas Contract.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Legion of Superheroes. It's the Great Darkness Saga. At least this is what I would say. I think there are a couple other contenders in both cases. Don't get me wrong. But, I mean, like, for DC, Crisis on Infinite Earths. No-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the other events like that. And when you start to have events that resonate or echo from previous events, again, Civil War II, Civil War, that certainly is a potential sales boost for the previous one.
Absolutely.
You know, you know, I was thinking the other day that it'd be tempting, had I nothing but time, and of course I don't, to go back and reread a lot of the Marvel events of the last decade or so, and almost put together, here's the formula. You gotta kill off at least two major characters. Whether you do it at the beginning of the story or end of the story, okay, that's just a variation or whatever. But what are the other cliche things that just seem to happen every time? You know, okay, you've got to, you know, throw somebody out of one team onto another, you know, or whatever.
You know, what's interesting, you bring that up. You know, we've talked about the Marvel Unlimited app before, but one of the things is, one of the things I actually really appreciate about that is that Marvel is constantly updating that app. And one of the areas of focus they've had the last probably 6 to 8 months is making it much easier to, or their events are much more organized. They have they've made it so they put them in reading order for you. You can search for the event, or they even have subsections where you literally just, it has the big banner of what the event is. You click on it, then they list the 60 or 70 issues because they have all the tie-ins, and they list them in order. And you can literally just start reading. And obviously you can it'll keep your place. You can just kind of slowly work your way through. And it's a really good way for them to really encourage people to read through their history, especially being Marvel is so event-based in terms of big changes and things like that. So it's really interesting you talk about that. Marvel Unlimited has really put an effort into making that much easier than it used to be. It used to be where you literally had to go online to Wikipedia, figure out where all the sub events took place, you know, because they have the main series, but then which books did it branch off into? And then you had to go search for those sub books, where now they finally pulled everything in. So if it was part of that series or that event, it's already collected in there, and you don't have to worry about finding all the little shoot offs.
Well, and again, I've got a coworker who's doing that with, I think he's already finished. I'm not sure if he's finished with Civil War or not, but that was one of the draws to the app. It's like, for, you know, a very negligible cost per month, go read to your heart's content.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great way to get the casual fan, keep them engaged.
Well, I think also, if you really think about it, one of the biggest complaints you get from, you know, outside of you, because you buy everything, one of the biggest complaints you get from the casual fan or the normal comic book fan is they can afford and are willing to buy the main event. But when everything crosses over, it's just, you know, money wise, it's just not possible to have everything. Right. So sometimes if you're a diehard fan, you feel like you might be missing out on this on a part of the story, and you feel bummed about that. Well, with Marvel Unlimited, yes, it takes 6 months for things to show up, but once it shows up, you don't have to worry about not being able to read everything. You can read everything that was tied into that event.
Let's talk about that for a moment, because I think right now with Civil War II going on, it's a very relevant topic, this whole, you know, line-wide event and crossovers and things like that. And it seems to me that cost is definitely a major factor. If it crosses over to everything, you're not going to get everyone to buy stuff. It runs the risk of pushing people out of the event entirely.
Mm-hmm.
If they're only just marginally interested, and it seems like, well, I've got to read this, that, and the other to keep up. But from a reader perspective, I'm curious what you and our listeners think about what should they be doing with these? Should they not be doing the tie-ins? If they do the tie-ins, should they be pivotal, must-read things, therefore they're worth reading, or not so pivotal so you can skip them, but if they're not pivotal enough to be worth reading, should they even be doing them? I mean, what's the ideal scenario here? What's the right choice for these creators, these publishers, to be making? Because I think there are certain events that it doesn't make sense to not have everybody kind of, you know, impacted by on an immediate basis. And I mean literally the worlds will live, worlds will die level of event.
Uh-huh.
You know, Secret Wars, Crisis, Flashpoint for that matter, things of that sort. I don't think they need to be doing these on a yearly basis. I certainly don't think they need to be doing them on a quarterly basis, which it almost feels like is happening. But there are times where I think it stretches credibility for certain events, certain characters to just be oblivious that they even happened. I don't know. Because, I mean, the whole concept of event fatigue, you know, has been talked about literally for years. Yet, events still do fairly well.
Yeah.
They're still coming out very often. And when they're well done, I think people like them. I mean, they typically are at the top of the charts. But a lot of people complain, and rightfully so, that titles get shanghaied, that their budget gets, you know, blown out of the water, or they can't follow along, or what have you. So, again, I'm curious what other people are thinking on this.
No, I agree. I think, you know, the other thing that complicates it is, especially on Marvel's side, they've started to aggressively price their, you know, the main event trades. And one of the things I do hear from people a decent amount now is that it's almost like the events are so constant now, and the quote-unquote game-changing outcomes from these events, it's almost hard to care anymore. You know what I mean? And the price increases and the constant events and worrying about, are you getting the whole story? Are you buying enough of the line? Those kind of things, I think, can wear people down.
Absolutely. When I was at, I think it was the Dallas convention. Where I picked up the stuff from Overground Comics. You know, the guy there was basically kind of saying how the superhero genre is just kind of broken with all the events, the game-changing status quos that then have another game-changing status quo to either flip it back or you know, whatever. It's like, so I definitely think that there is an aspect of the shared universe that, while it's cool and I love it, is struggling creatively and I think also at times financially.
Mm-hmm.
Witness the fact that, you know, we only had two items over, well, actually, if you go to five, we had two items over 6,000 this time around. Only a third made it also above 4,600, you know, and you go to if you use 4,000 as the break-off point, we've got, what, seven items? I mean, this was, and with the trade side, just like with the comic side, it's a little at the mercy of, well, just what came out that month, you know, but we're talking May, we're not talking January, which is often a slow month because everybody rushed their stuff out so they could get those December sales or whatever or what have you. This was kind of I don't say a lackluster month, but when two of the top three items are reorder activity, that kind of says something. You know, if you figure, again, there's 2,000-ish stores or whatever out there, most stores aren't getting a copy of most of these books.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and again, I don't think they should get a copy of many of these books. Everything is getting collected. I'm curious how much longer that's going to go on. You know, there was a point a couple of years back. It made sense. You've got it. Slap a trade cover on it. You know, put it out there and, you know, print to order. Kind of a low risk situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's still a low-risk situation, but I think it's also an increasingly low-reward situation. Because if somebody just missed a particular issue, well, hell, they can get it digitally.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious how digital and trades are going to, I don't want to say fight it out moving forward, but how it plays out. Because the stuff I'm hearing anecdotally is that digital sales have kind of leveled off. Trade sales, I think, have cooled off. Not necessarily overall. There are certain books that just do gangbusters, you know, Walking Dead, Saga, stuff like that. But the average trade, not doing that hot.
Yeah, definitely.
I think there's just less need for this stuff. And I think I'm getting an increased sense from the people I talk with of the print version is almost more trouble than it's worth to a lot of people. And going digitally, either for the comic, the trade, whatever, just makes more sense. And believe me, I know how quickly this stuff can stack up, so I get that. I just wonder how many more years, if that, even if it's in years, you know, every issue of Spider-Gwen gets collected, or every issue of, you know, Martian Manhunter, or whatever mid to low list book from Marvel or DC, you know, just automatically gets collected.
Mm-hmm.
Because now, from a indie point of view, and I'm going to throw Image in that category, it makes sense to do the trades. You've got the convention sales, you got the long tail. For them, I think it's a winning game. For Marvel, though, it's almost going to get to the point where it may be an incentive to get people into the Digital Comics Unlimited stuff if they stop reprinting everything in trade. I don't know how that's going to play out.
It will be interesting to watch, because I think you're right that there will be certain calculations made. I think in the indie world, a huge part of the sustainability of those projects is the trade selection.
Absolutely.
You know, and in some ways, for certain creators, I think it actually is the only way for them to be profitable and continue. So I think they'll hold on a lot longer, but you're absolutely right about certain really marginal big two books. It's going to be interesting to see. It really is going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, I find this stuff just fascinating because there was a point where I was very convinced that trade sales were going to take over as kind of the primary revenue stream for comic book stories, and that the reliance on single issue sales would just kind of fade away. And not immediately, but there'd come that tipping point where the trades are enough to sustain that the monthly issues are just the cost break, the cash flow ease, that kind of a deal. But that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of why that didn't happen was digital. But I don't know how much of it was that. So it's a crazy marketplace to watch.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Comics. That's why it's so funny sometimes listening to you talk to Sam, because you can tell a lot that Sam is very logical and he like wants to apply logic. But this market is so screwed up in so many ways. And you could just tell in his tone of his voice, it drives him nuts.
I like to think I'm a logical person, too, but I've been doing this long enough to know that it just doesn't apply here.
Yeah. No.
But yeah, I know what you mean. And that's part of what I love talking with Sam about this stuff. Yeah. It's like, but you should just do this or whatever. And it's like, well, yeah, but...
But it doesn't work that way.
And sometimes for historical reasons, sometimes for really crazy reasons.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You know, the one thing I didn't have a chance to talk with Sam about this month, when we recorded just, frankly, just a couple of days ago, was this whole news about Hastings.
Mm-hmm.
They've declared bankruptcy, and... The list of some of their creditors in the geek area, a little staggering. One of them was Diamond Book Distributors, which is, of course, the book arm of Diamond,
mm-hmm.
Which is apparently owed, I think, $1.6+ million.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that's going to, you know, break Diamond or anything. It's certainly not going to help them.
Yeah.
And hopefully they had a little bit of warning that this might be coming. But the other one that's kind of staggering is... the almost $2.6 million to Funko.
Yeah, no, I actually was more surprised at how much toy exposure that they had.
It kind of makes sense because those Funko things are, what, 15, 20 bucks a pop or something maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you gotta have one, not one of each at every store, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it adds up really quickly, but it really makes me wonder on... the sustained value of those Funko Pop toys, and is that a bubble that's going to burst? Is this the kind of thing that could burst that bubble?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Funko obviously is got a lot of other revenue streams. They're doing a half a dozen, I think, different subscription boxes themselves. Their stuff is going into another plethora of boxes. But this is a pretty big rock in the pond or whatever with Hastings.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a tough situation. You know, I think the articles that I've read about it said that they're looking for a buyer. And if they aren't able to find one in pretty short order, it's going to become a liquidation issue. And, you know, that's concerning because, you know, a lot of that unsold inventory, when that happens, the creators don't get any sort of, they don't get credit for those books. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In terms of, royalties and things like that. So it's kind of unfortunate from the creator's perspective, but you know, that's just the same thing happened with Borders. It was kind of an unfortunate end for one of the bigger retailers for our material.
Borders, I see, is a little bit of a different case because while they carried a lot of this stuff, they were doing it on definitely a returnable basis, and it, to me, was just a bigger blow for books and reading in general than the comic market in particular.
Mm-hmm.
But Hastings had the potential of becoming, and to a degree, was almost the first, I don't know if it was nationwide, but first really huge comic book chain. Yet they didn't seem to be able to leverage that for any kind of economy of scale, because from what I was reading, they've lost like $25 million in the last 2 years. Now, obviously, they've got a ton of stuff other than comics. Obviously, all the Funko stuff, they've got, you know, other toys, books, movies, etc. But it's disappointing. I would have liked to have seen them, you know, find a way to really make a run as a large comic book chain.
Yeah.
I think there's a certain economy of scale that if you had enough outlets, if you could leverage them in a synergistic manner, stuff that doesn't sell at one, you get to the location that needs it, those sorts of issues. There's a lot you could do. Almost take the concept of a comic book chain and toss in almost the Wizard World traveling show mentality to it, if you will, where it's like, you know, you've got one thing that can now coordinate, hey, let's have this creator sign here, 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 and here, or whatever, as they're doing, you know, whatever else would justify that kind of travel.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think this is a potential heavier hit to the market, because not only is the book side hit, but anybody who was getting their comics through Hastings, because, well, that was their option, do we lose them as readers?
That's true, because I know that they were in a decent amount of communities. They were one of the small. They were one of the only bookstores, you know. So that is also, you know, just a loss of access, you know. And then there's the Amazon option, but there's just a certain segment of the population that's not comfortable shopping that way, you know.
But not just the book side; they carried comics.
Yeah, that's true.
So on the periodical side, how much of a hit is that going to be? I mean, do we start to notice certain titles, and it's going to be hard because it's going to be masked by the Rebirth relaunch at DC and things like that. Are we going to see some of those titles just dropping by whatever the orders for Hastings might have been?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. We'll see.
But it's never good for, you know, a major retailer like that to leave the market, particularly under a bankruptcy situation where it could ripple to other places.
Gotcha.
Because I can't imagine that the $1.6 million that Diamond Book Distributors was expecting to get, may not. You know, that again, not going to help them any. And then how does that ripple across all the other stuff that Diamond does? And maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Maybe there's firewalls between it. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But not a good thing.
Yeah, hopefully they'll be able to find a buyer to remain solvent, but we'll see.
I hope so, but I don't know who it would be.
Yeah, no, retailing is a tough business for sure.
Well, and it's not like it's otherwise thriving except for Hastings.
Yeah.
You know, again, Borders is out of the picture. Barnes & Noble is really the only other, one of the only other major chains. Books-A-Million, I think, is another one. And I'm trying to think what other books sellers are kind of big deals these days.
I think those are the last few remaining multi-state big ones for sure.
So it's not like there's a thriving market that somebody says, man, I just need to get into that. Amazon seems to be opening up their own stores already, so it's not like I think they need Hastings.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm going to be curious to see where this goes. My gut feeling, the odds of a buyer coming in seems like a long shot.
Oh, I definitely think it's low, but we'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly wouldn't object if it happens. So what else do we got in here that looks interesting? Oh, we got the Joker Endgame at rank number 7.
Mm-hmm.
That surprises me a little. I think that's a new release, though.
Yes, so that is... Now, is that different than the Batman trade? Or is that the... This is the specific Joker version, right?
This has got stories from Batman 35 to 40, Batman Annual 3, Gotham Academy Endgame, Batgirl Endgame, Detective Endgame, Arkham Manor Endgame. So, I'm not sure what was in the Batman one.
I think not a lot of the Endgame ones.
Okay. That one, I think, is there more just because it's a new release than
gotcha.
Any connection with the Joker stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to see if there's anything else that's particularly surprising. One of the things lower on the list, jumping down to rank 66, is Avengers K, Volume 1. It's a trade paperback. I don't know if this is technically original material or not. It's the Avengers backstory or history kind of re-envisioned by some South Korean artists and writers.
Interesting. I've never heard of it.
I picked it up. I haven't read it yet. I don't know if this is something that was going on in South Korea or if they're just saying, let's get that, you know, style of comic applied to the Avengers and see what happens. I'm pretty sure a second volume has been solicited. But like I said, trades have a bad habit of sitting unread in my, my stacks just cause I've got so many, single issues to go through. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the few kind of original, if it is indeed original, and I'm thinking it is, but I'm not positive, but it's one of the few original things on the list. Most of the rest of the stuff is, you know, collected editions or whatnot.
Yeah.
We were talking about how for creator-owned stuff, trades are often kind of that lifeblood to keep the property moving and stuff. Rank 83... Symmetry Volume 1 from Image Comic. This is a $9.99 trade. This is one of the ones by... This is a Matt Hawkins book, right?
I'm not sure if he writes that one. I'm not
yes.
sure.
Yes, he does.
Okay.
Raphael Ionco is doing the art on it.
Okay.
1216. So not, you know, lighting the charts on fire, but good story. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I'm hoping it goes to a second and third volume. I know he's got plans for it, but I'm pretty sure it was the letter page at the end of the fourth issue that this collects that was saying, well, you know, if the market doesn't support it, it, you know, can't keep coming out.
Yeah. So that's definitely a book that I don't read, so I'm not sure what the single issue sales are like.
I would have to go dig them up. On that side, I don't think it was lighting the world on fire either.
The tragedy of comics business.
Yeah, very much so. I think it's hard for anything to really get a foothold, and this was brand new property, one of the plethora of things, Image launches in any given month. It's hard for things to get noticed and get that foothold to where they can have a chance at survival.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the ones that is, I'm going to go with slightly ironic, down at rank 103, we've got the Flashpoint trade paperback, reorder activity of 1,073 units. Its total known that I found on the list so far is 25,200, which actually is a little surprising. I would have thought that would have been a little higher by now. I just find it ironic, given that we just had Rebirth that kind of not killed off, but it was a major turning point on the new 52, you know, universe that came out of the aftermath of Flashpoint.
Yeah, no, I haven't read a lot of that stuff since as a trade reader, you know, it's definitely not out yet, but didn't they basically reset the universe to right when Flashpoint happened, so as if the new 52 never happened?
No, they did not.
Oh, okay.
Certain people have said that, but that's absolutely not how I have read it.
Oh, okay, because that, you know, I'm sorry I didn't quite get it right, because the few interpretations I've had, they were basically, it was a way for the person who was speaking on a podcast to basically chide DC for admitting that the new 52 was a complete waste, because their version of it was that, that it basically, the whole reboot or relaunch negates the new 52. So that's not the case though.
There were aspects of Rebirth that seemed to decisions made as part of the new 52 as tragic mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Best left forgotten or killed off or whatever, and just let's put that behind us, sort of a thing. But it's a matter of, I think, DC wanting to have their cake and eat it too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not unique to DC. I mean, you look at the post-Secret War Marvel Universe, where everything moved forward 8 months and things are just different. You know, we've seen that with 1 year later. We've seen that time and time again at the different companies to different degrees and extents. And there comes a point where I get that you need to have a little bit of space from what's gone before to move the story forward.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how we wind up with kind of breaks in the continuity and a lack of interest and relevance to stories from years past. Because, I mean, the fact that Killing Joke was at the top of the list this time around is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to do some research to say, okay, when did that was 28 years ago or whatever. So what was happening in the Batman comics at the time? And how completely irrelevant is that stuff from Detective and Batman from what, 1998 or something, to today's continuity? Whether you consider that to be the rebirth or even the new 52 continuity, or mm-hmm. even the two or three before that. Because really 1988 would have been just about 3 years into post-crisis.
Yeah, for sure.
So, I mean, the part of what I think has hurt back issue sales, and then by extension trade paperback sales, is there's really no major incentive to go chase some of these old stories down. They don't matter anymore, because they may not have ever happened to the current characters.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, I mean, who cares what happened in the Tim Drake Robin title that went on for, what, 100, 200 issues? I mean, an incredibly long time. When he was in the new continuity, maybe never Robin, maybe he was just Red Robin, maybe those stories never happened. That's the kind of thing where editorial decisions make the job of selling and leveraging this huge library the companies have just increasingly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's easy to pick on DC in that regard, because I think they've been a bit more extreme, but in different ways, it's very much a problem over at Marvel. You know, I don't think there's a big demand for Ironworks or Fantastic Force or some of these other offshoots of major brands that lasted a year or two and then were very pleasantly forgotten afterwards. And not necessarily because they were bad. Some of them were just a very much a product of their times. It's just, I would think that if we were seeing sales at the level we're seeing, I mean, the midpoint on the list here is 797 units. Half the items did that or better, half did that or lower. So 800, we'll say, for easy rounding. I wouldn't be too troubled with that if every month we had like 250 different items on the list. And sure, you're going to have 50 or so that are, you know, the Walking Dead, the stable, ever-present type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if there was a constant, hey, you know, this did another couple hundred and it's you know, going to be gone for a little bit, but, you know, it's going to come back and do a little bit more. But this whole history of great stuff is constantly getting reprinted out to a new audience and enjoyed or whatever. That would be cool. That's not what we're having. We're seeing stuff pop on the list, often to never be seen again, or it's stuff that we just see hundreds of times.
Mm-hmm.
There's not necessarily that much of a middle ground there. And a lot of it comes down to just how old some of the material is as to how many times we've seen it on the list before. Rank 140, we've got Atomic Robo and the Ring of Fire trade paperback from IDW. First collection of the Atomic Robo stuff under them, I believe. 848 units. Atomic Robo, fairly robust property. So I'm expecting to see more of it through them. And I think this is like the eighth trade or something.
Yeah, actually, interesting that you bring that up. I just ordered through DCBS. So when they brought that property over to IDW, they reissued the previous trades in three trades in one volume, pretty thick paperback, you know, 400 page paperbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I just ordered a couple of those to, you know, cause I had read the most of that series in digital, but I liked it so much that I wanted a permanent copy. So I finally ordered those, and they're just the last previews, they put out the third of those big kind of compendiums. And I think they're finally caught up to the most current two, regular trade paperbacks that they just released.
It's great stuff.
Oh yeah, no, I love Atomic Robo.
They were one of the things that really put Red 5 Comics on the map for me.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a period where most of what Red 5 was publishing was very much in line with the types of stuff I wanted to be reading. Over time, they've drifted. Their tastes and my tastes have drifted a little, which, you know, has happened. Nothing wrong with that. But Atomic Robo moving over to first digital and then over to IDW was a little bit of the a hit for me in terms of how much of Red 5 stuff I'm getting these days. Matter of fact, I'd be hard-pressed to name the last thing I did get from them, just because, again, they're not publishing as much as they were at one point, and with Atomic Robo being one of the main things I was getting from them, no longer there.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, for me, the secret of the back half of previews is, you know, once I find a title in there I like, you know, I take note of who it's by, and then I look at the other stuff by that publisher. Because in some cases, Big Dog Inc., a lot of it was written by the same guy. I think it's Tom Hutchinson. I could get the name wrong. But, you know, I liked his sensibility. I liked his different books, and they were fairly different in times. But it's like, okay, that's stuff that all other things being equal, if I saw the same solicit minus the list of creators, and the only thing I knew is it's by Red Five or Big Dog or a small press publisher I know, or somebody else, or worse, somebody I know but don't like. Because there are certain publishers, it's like, you know, if something's coming out from Avatar, they do great stuff, don't get me wrong.
It's not for you.
It is not for me. It tends to be harder-edged, a bit gorier.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I, you know, every once in a while, like, so the things that I do read at Avatar, 95% of the stuff they put out, I don't, have no interest in. But that's one of the only places that Garth Ennis can get his war comics published. So I do read those when he publishes stuff. Every once in a while, Alan Moore will put out some material there. In fact, mm-hmm. he's on a series called Providence right now. So every once in a while, for specific reasons, like Garth Ennis' war comics, so I think his pretty much the best person doing war comics in the last 20 years. And also, you know, when Alan Moore does stuff, I try to pay attention. So I'm the same way. Like, a publisher that's similar for me is Zenoscope. I think I do not like what Zenoscope publishes. And I glance over their stuff really quickly, basically.
I find their cover art to be really nice. I have not read that many books by them.
Mm-hmm.
I've had mixed feelings on some of the ones I have read.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of thing that I think it's entirely probable they could do a book that I would just love. The question is, would I discover the book?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's one of those where Zenoscope, for good or ill, I think has a definitive identity as to the kind of books they do.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there are other publishers that really kind of narrowing down what kind of a book it is just based on, well, it's by thus and so publisher, kind of hard.
Yeah, for sure.
Boom covers the gambit. Now, granted, they've got their imprints of, you know, Boom Kids and this, that, and the other to help narrow it down. But having a definitive identity for a publisher, a plus and a minus, you know, it can mm-hmm. be very helpful, but it could also steer people away from a book they would otherwise like if it's atypical of what you typically do.
Absolutely.
So, now, one of the things we've talked about in the past are these adult coloring books.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of them on the list this time around. We've got the Color Your Own Civil War and Color Your Own Deadpool at 166 and 167. I have not checked out either of these. I'm assuming they've taken the colorist credit off the solicits. These things are doing, let's see, that was $725 a piece for those. That's not too bad. And again, we're talking about how that's almost free money for them.
Absolutely.
We've got the Coloring DC Batman Adventures Mad Love, again on the list, down at rank 232. I thought I saw a couple others here on the list. That stuff that, you know, hey, I'm not into that, but hey, if it's working for these publishers and making them some money and making some readers happy, that's, hey, it's all good.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see what else. I mean, part of it with a list where so much of it is in the just a couple hundred units category is it very much comes across as a bit of a ho-hum kind of a month.
Yeah, you know, and as with a lot of months, there's just a lot of reorder activity. That's kind of what we talked about a little at the very beginning. It just depends on how quickly retailers turn this product, and if they hone in quickly on what they can turn quickly, then they're going to reorder more of it. You know what I mean? And so you know, this, it's sometimes hard to look for trends because there's so much reorder activity.
Well, and when I see this much reorder activity, because it feels like there's just almost 60% of the list is reorders.
Mm-hmm.
it makes me wonder about the strength of the newer material.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Ninth Generation Volume 2 down at rank 277. That was some of the future stuff going on in the Top Cow universe. This is, again, by Matt Hawkins, did the last four issues. 449 units. And that's something where was that even worth publishing for them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if maybe it is, maybe it's not. I don't know. I could see where if they didn't do that as trade, there's now incentive for the people to have gotten the single issues. And I don't know if it was originally geared to be an eight-issue series or if it just ended at that point. It had a nice conclusion. It was well done. I enjoyed it. But didn't go quite the direction I was expecting it to based on how it started. I was expecting more of the artifacts to come into play. But I think the entire Top Cow universe is in a case study of various sorts. It was one that went on very long, very strong. I think had a really good resurgence at one point with Ron Mars. Then when they did the artifacts stuff and essentially rebooted their universe, I think it just killed it at that point. I am seriously wondering if they had that decision to do over and to change the outcome of the artifacts storyline to not essentially be a something of a reboot, if they would have been better off just continuing with the continuity they had. Don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm not familiar. I haven't read a lot in that universe, so I can't really speak to it.
Well, I was really liking it, but when you change both the creative team and the take on the characters.
Yeah, it's hard to get people to stay bought in.
Yeah. You know, it was one of the concerns I had when in Doctor Who on the TV show, they were replacing the Doctor, the Companion, and the lead writer and showrunner all at once. And I'm like, well, is this even going to be the same show? It worked out fine for me, but that's a big risk to take. Go ahead and filter out some of this reorder activity, see if we've got anything exciting on the new things just lost in the shuffle with that. We Stand on Guard Deluxe Edition, that was at rank number 5. I thought that was a entertaining series by Brian K. Vaughan that did 4,036 units. Grayson, that's volume 3. That's issues 9 through 12 and annual number 1. That's not even really kind of current material. That did 2,360 units. I'm curious how that'll do for future volumes of that now that that series is getting replaced and they're going back to Nightwing. 20th anniversary, Kingdom Come. Hardcover did 2,074 units at rank 31. Gotham Central Omnibus. I assume that collects the whole run. The entire 40 issue. Wow. Anyone who hasn't read Gotham Central, this is a run by Brubaker and Rucka on the writing and Michael Lark predominantly on the art. It yes. had Harvey Bullock, Maggie Sawyer, Renee Montoya, and other Gotham City police detectives. And it was a police procedural in Gotham.
Oh, it's such a good series. I can't recommend it highly enough. I almost bought that omnibus on top of already owning all the paperbacks, but I had to save my money for something else, but I was so tempted because it's such a good series. And what the key to it, I think, is so important is that they committed to not having Batman in it and really committed to the focus on the other characters. And he really let Brubaker expand those characters out, show them warts and all. It was just such a good series.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was, I think at one point the Titans showed up, but not as the superheroes to come save the day. I think they were actually part of the investigation or being investigated or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was a primetime police procedural in Gotham. It was amazing.
No, and it was just so good. And I really think that it's such a great creative team because Ed Brubaker loves that type of setting and that type of character development. And he's just so good at those crime stories. And I don't know, the way that it was color and the lighting and everything, it was done so well to set the mood and really draw you into that environment. And I got so engrossed in it, you know, quote unquote, in the Batman world, but, you know, had almost nothing to do with Batman. It was so good.
This is the kind of book, if I were building a new 52 or Rebirth or whatever kind of a lineup at DC,
mm-hmm.
I would do. Now, I would maybe tweak the name of it a little to where you could do some of the stories in Gotham. You have a similar kind of a group over in Metropolis or something. But it's essentially, this is the, whatever, you know, you've got a homicide division, a burglary division, whatever the superpower division is at the various cities. Because I think the boots on the ground, the cops who have to deal with the crazy of gods, superpowers, etc. There's a lot of really powerful stories to be had there. And again, I think Brubaker and Rucka just on the writing did phenomenal work there. Then, of course, Rucka and Lark are working together on Lazarus these days. And down at rank number 67, we've got the second volume of the hardcover of Lazarus, 1,400 units. Definitely worth checking out. Continue to scan down the list. Got a Captain Marvel Volume 6, Marvel Masterwork. The other one right above that. Wow. Batman Dark Knight Returns Gallery Edition Hardcover, $175. This is the number one retail rank. And at $175, it doesn't have to sell that many to beat out everything else, even though it was at rank 91 in terms of units. 1,165 units on that. That had Dark Knight Returns, 3-4, scan in full color from the original black and white pages. Yeah, this is definitely, you know, again, gallery edition from graffiti, go figure. I have a hard enough time spending the money on the artist editions from IDW. When they have some of these things that are even more expensive, cool though they may be, it's just, man, that's...
Yeah, you definitely have to be careful, because once you actually get an artist edition and you look at it and you see how nice it is, it becomes very hard. It becomes very easy to want more of them, believe me.
My recommendation on that is either do artist edition or original art.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good point.
And I have opted not to do original art. I only have like 4 or 5 pieces. And those are all gifts or whatever, but I've picked up a couple of the artist edition because, yeah, I saw one. It's like, that's kind of cool. Now, just ironically, I hadn't realized it was on here. Remember how I was talking about Forceworks a little while ago and big demand for that? Apparently, the demand is 562 because the Avengers Iron Man Forceworks trade paperback is at rank 213. Collecting Forceworks 1 through 11, 12, the main story there, 13 through 15, and a few other things here and there.
Gotcha.
But it was by Abnett and Lanning, and it wasn't bad. It just was a weird take on kind of the West Coast Avengers. Back in the day when everybody was trying to get all proactive. we'll see how that works out for people. Man, we're getting some of these things a little further down the list, like the Mirror's Edge Exordium trade paperback at rank 288, 439 units. That's part of the video game stuff. It is what led up to, I think, the newest game. I don't play the game, but I like the story. But that's 439 units across, say, 2,000 stores. This just isn't getting into everything. And again, it's a niche thing, so I wouldn't expect it to, but where do they draw the line? When are they going to get to the point where it's more trouble than it's worth to put some of those out?
Well, I think you're seeing some of that at some of the other publishers, like Boom deciding to pare back some of their line this year in terms of what they're publishing and focus more of their marketing on what they are successful at. And it will be interesting to see in the long run. You know, I think that Marvel and DC kind of have built engines to produce the amount of material that they do. But for some of the middle tier publishers like Oni, Dark Horse, IDW, Boom, I think that middle class, and obviously the bottom guys, the farm league is hemmed in by resources and just not having enough resources to publish more, even if they wanted to. But it's that middle class that has to be very careful about not overextending themselves.
I think it extends even to DC.
You think so?
Look at the nature of some of the changes they've made with Rebirth and how they are going to fewer titles. So there's less kind of characters and storylines they need to keep track of.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things they flat out stated in some of the roadshow and interview stuff leading up to Rebirth, is they were having a hard time keeping track of, well, what's going on with Green Lantern versus Green Lantern, you know, Corps versus Green Arrow versus Black Canary versus Batgirl versus... Well, then
how does Marvel do it? Do they just not care about continuity? They just do what they want?
You know, that's a tough question. I think there's an argument could be made on both sides of that one.
Yeah, or because they restart all their series after issue 12, it doesn't matter anyway.
I think my take on this as a complete outsider, while I have some displeasure with Brevoort and how he's run a few things and how he's handled a few particular situations, he's incredibly knowledgeable about the history of comics, both I think from the business side and the continuity story side. But also, I think by and large, Marvel has a pretty good editorial team. And I am not seeing any standouts that I can think of off the top of my head over at DC. Whereas I could name probably a couple of editors over at Marvel that I've actually taken distinct notice of. And wow, they're doing some interesting stuff on the books under them. And I'm going to mispronounce her name, Aminat or whatever, the editor behind titles like Ms. Marvel and stuff, is definitely not only pushing diversity, but pushing getting not just, hey, let's do a token version of, you know, this character is another ethnicity, but getting people who actually can tell that story that seemingly relates to people of that ethnicity and people not of that ethnicity, which I think is a pretty challenging thing and a pretty mean feat. But they're growing the lineup of characters and diversity of the Marvel lineup and stuff in a very interesting and innovative way. From, you know, Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, Mockingbird, Black Widow, Spider-Gwen, Silk, Spider-Woman... I mean, there's a ton of female lead characters these days over at Marvel. And it wasn't that long ago, oh, female leads, that just doesn't sell, you know? So I think part of it is they've got, in a few cases over at Marvel, some very passionate editors, some very talented editors, and are able to coordinate with their creative team and do some great stuff. Whereas it seems like a lot of what led to Rebirth was almost a complete disintegration of sorts, either of communication or something, within DC editorial, going up the chain through the invisible Bob Harris, editor-in-chief, to Geoff Johns, Dan Didio, and Jim Lee, who apparently had no idea what the hell was going on in their books. Or did, but not in a timely enough manner to do anything about it. So, I think that Marvel is operating in a stronger position because they've got a game book that is at times transparent, but it works. Hey, let's do this major change to a character. Yep, we're going to have to undo it in about a year, but that's just our next major turning point, new number one, and, you know, ta-da. And I would be hard-pressed to name any major shift or whatever that they've done at Marvel with a character that didn't have an equally obvious, this is that next move, and when that came along, sometimes that next move was clear. Sometimes not so much. You know, you do the Superior Spider-Man, you know you're going to go back to the Amazing. You do Superior Iron Man, that's only going to last so long. You know, you go with a female Thor, sooner or later the old Thor is going to come back. Well, what happens to her? Okay, that's not so clear. But it's got this self-propelling momentum to it, whereas I look over at DC and I don't see that. It's more of a catch-up and repair than a virtuous cycle that's ever uplifting. So
That is a good point. It's just interesting how, I don't know, I feel like it, and maybe this is just partially my DC bias, but I just feel like there's so many things that Marvel does that are anti-comic book fan in terms of the pricing, the event pricing, the double shipping, and it feels like the market doesn't punish them for any of it. Do you know what I mean? Like, they overprice their trades and hardcovers. They're ridiculously priced, especially their hardcover stuff. They give you less number of issues per trade. You know, I don't know. I just don't understand why they never seem to be punished for what I view as not treating their customers as good as they could. But maybe I value different things than the people that are buying.
Well, I know exactly where you're coming from. $3.99, $4.99 prices on Marvel Comics are tough to swallow. Mm-hmm. Again, we look at the average price on the trades list here. And Marvel's average price is $27.20 compared to DC's $23.38 and Image's $16.14.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the average price on the comics side, and it's not quite as skewed, but they've got the highest average price there, too.
Mm-hmm.
So are they doing things that are, from a reader perspective, expensive and kind of sucks? Absolutely. But they're a business.
Mm-hmm.
Their goal is to make money.
I don't in any way think that they are, you know, morally wrong or anything in that sense. I just think that I don't find satisfaction in the market rewarding them for in my opinion behavior that may not be in the long term interests of comics. Now, obviously, as a for profit company, they have no responsibility for the long term benefit of comics. Their responsibility is to increase the price of Disney's shares. But you get my point, you know.
But the question is their self-interest long-term or short-term?
Yeah. Yeah. And in my view, the things that they choose to do is short-term.
Absolutely. And they've always had a very short-term attitude.
Mm-hmm.
In one or two cases I can point to, the shortness of the short-term was staggering.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many years ago, there was the expo that was connected to the San Diego Comic-Con. And this would be where the retailers would get together, and it was kind of, you know, what a part of like they would do the road show these days, but it was just a standing part of San Diego. The publishers would get up, do their presentations or whatever. And I got to go to them a couple of years because, you know, I used to work at a store in San Diego and whatnot. And there was one point where DC would be talking. Now, mind you, this was Bob Wayne getting up there and doing it. And Bob Wayne is many things. Dynamic public speaker? Maybe not so much. Sarcastic as all hell? Damn straight. He'd make a very interesting late night talk show host, I think. But he would be going through their plans, and you know, the retailer crowd, not the most excitable group necessarily. But he also was going through the plans for like the next year, and there were often times that by the time the next San Diego had come around, they hadn't actually delivered on everything because it was that long of a gestation period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that it was delayed. This was the plan. So they knew what they were doing, and they were not thinking just knee-jerk. And in one of those same years, the Marvel presentation was, here's what we're doing this month, the next month, and the month after. And literally, one of the retailers says, you know, I've read previews. I know all of this. What are you doing after that? And there's this hemming and hawing on stage, because this is around the time of the bankruptcy, and I forget who was in charge of Marvel that week. But it was around the point where their tenure was about that much.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seemed like the people up there, they had no longer-term plan. They probably didn't need one. They weren't going to be there that long. But it was also clear, because I flat-out asked them at that point, what are you reading as president of Marvel, whoever it was that day? And it's like, well, you know, I'm a president, I'm a busy man, don't really have time. And I'm like, so you're not reading these things, essentially, was what he was saying. And at times, I'm getting a feel, to a degree, with potentially Jim Lee, Dan Didio and stuff. And I know they're busy guys. I know they've got a lot on their plate, not just Marvel Comics, but the whole Marvel, or not Marvel, DC, the DC entertainment stuff. There's a lot going on with the movies, the cartoons, the TV shows, etc. It doesn't take that much damn time to read the comics. And if you're not doing that and you can't keep track of it and shoot off a, you know, is it really a good idea to go this way with this character? Kind of a letter to the editor who works for you?
Mm-hmm.
You deserve what you get.
I agree.
But I agree that Marvel, while they've got that short-term attitude, has done some crazy things in terms of pricing, in terms of how often they're coming out with the books, in terms of how quickly they're recycling to a new number one, this whole season model, which I think is potentially going to become a death spiral. I mean, years ago, I talked about the whole concept of a growing forest of dying trees and how we were going to get to the point where titles just didn't last long enough to really get an audience or go past a story or two.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? We're here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think short story arc miniseries can work, but not in the same way that ongoing shared universe type stuff of Days Gone By works. I think there's a different mindset to doing something along the lines of like a Legends of the Dark Knight, where you just tell a Batman story at random points in his timeline. If he's got a coherent timeline, you can do that. If you keep rejuggling his timeline and how old is he, who was his sidekick when, did he even have that guy as a sidekick or whatever? Bouncing around like that just isn't an option anymore. You don't have a stable foundation.
Mm-hmm.
I was seeing, I think it was on Comic Book Resources recently, a poll of do people want them to undo the One More Day stuff for Spider-Man? And it's like, I didn't even bother to click on what the result of the poll was, because to me, that's almost it's a bad question. Whether you agree with the decision they made or not, they made it, and undoing it just further compounds the problem.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's where Crisis caused problems for DC. That's where Zero Hour caused problems for DC. That's where Rebirth could cause problems for DC. You know, there is no fixing of some of these mistakes without compounding some of the mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's you can't keep repairing the same thing without further, you know, damaging it. I'm sure there's a good metaphor or analogy to be had there, but I don't have it. One other thing I want to mention, we were just talking about police procedurals and stuff like that a little earlier. Rank 171, The Fuse from Image, Volume 3, Perihelion, trade paperback, 694 units. This is basically your standard nighttime police procedural set on a space station.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony Johnson is riding this. Justin Greenwood's doing the art. It's one that reads well in trade because it's, you know, it's a 6-issue arc on the same mm-hmm. thing, same mystery or whatever.
Yeah, I've read the first two series and they're very good. I like it.
A definite amount of density to the material. There's some meat there.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely wanted to mention that one because I think it's good stuff. So is there other stuff on the list that looked interesting to you?
I think we covered most of it, you know, just kind of a lot of reorder going on this month. Some interesting things at the top, you know, potentially correlating with what the market considers, you know, are the movies coming, what can we sell, what can we push if people are interested in. And then, you know, just a little bit more of the same. It'll be interesting to see when we get some of the Civil War II, you know, obviously that's months away, Civil War II, and then also some of the first trades for the new DC stuff. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out compared to the previous events.
Well, and have we been getting some of the post-Secret Wars trades from Marvel yet? I haven't really...
I think a few have trickled out, but there's so many.
None that have really hit at the top with, wow, this was amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, go figure. If we look at the price points, man, they are just all over the map. $14.99, edged out $19.99 at a... 58 to 54 ratio kind of a thing there. $24.99, there was 34 items at that, and then 33 at $9.99. So I think if you take just those four, I mean, that's 60% of the list almost.
Mm-hmm.
But then we've got stuff from the $175, $100, $19.99 and stuff, all the way down to, again, the 33 at the $9.99. So we're seeing some higher ticket items, but by and large, I think it's very much skewing in the $20 and under. $20 and under, that's 74% of the list.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the lower price stuff is working out for people, which I'm okay with. I think they're better off selling things at the lower price points, getting it into more people's hands. Then, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love a really nice, coffee table kind of an addition or something that uber deluxe, wow, that was an amazing story, do an amazing presentation of it, but that doesn't really grow the audience.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't grow the hobby, the industry, whatever. And again, there's a time and a place for that kind of stuff, but getting this material out at a good price point where more people can read it, enjoy it, and get others hooked on it, really, I think that's what it's all about. And that's where I think, you know, the digital stuff has a key place in the market, and then also things like the Digital Comics Unlimited over at Marvel. I seriously think DC has missed a huge opportunity to not have a similar thing of their own. I also think, though, if they did, I would be very tempted to go with the Marvel and DC version of those, and then, you know, what would happen to the industry?
It would be an interesting question.
And it could be a long, drawn-out answer or a very short one. I don't know.
Yeah. Thoughts for another time. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, and we're getting towards convention time of the year. The next set of numbers will be coming out right around the time I'm heading off to San Diego. We tend to get a lot of big announcements sometimes, actually less so than last year or two around San Diego. I think they're saving them up for other times.
Mm-hmm.
Or just not to get lost in the crowd. But typically, a lot of things get released around convention time just so the creators have it at their tables and booths and stuff. So that may be part of why we had a little bit of a lackluster month this time.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Maybe gearing it towards more of a June, July type release.
Yeah, no, and that's especially true for the bigger books that they want to push. Yeah.
If I were a creator and I knew long enough ahead that I could plan accordingly, you know, what my convention schedule was going to be, I would definitely want to have books out just a few weeks before the convention, enough that I would be sure to have copies and not be cutting it down to the wire, but also new enough that if somebody hadn't been to the store in the last week or so, it's like, oh, they haven't seen it, you know, whatever. I'd want it to be at the store long enough I'm not undercutting the retailers, but not so long that they've forgotten, oh, yeah, it's out, I've already got it, and, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So. But that takes a lot of organization and a lot of pre-planning, because to do that, you not only need to know when you're at the convention, you need to know when your trade's going to come out, so you've got to have done your single issues in, you know, about a year in advance. I don't know how you do the math on that. But, hey, that's why some creators have books out, and some are saying, yeah, it's coming out in 3 weeks. So. And I hate it when they do that, because it's not good for them.
Yeah.
So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for this month.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or excuse, and items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the alternate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.